Yeah. Anyway, they killed it on the House. So.
Senate Committee on Health Services and Rural Health will come to order, please, and welcome. Not much traffic this morning, right? Okay. This morning we're going to have three public hearing and possible work sessions on three bills dealing with the naturopathic board and physicians. And the first bill is Senate Bill 131, and we will open a public hearing. And Ann Walsh and Rick Marinelli.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 131 changes the name of the Board of Naturopathic Examiners to the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine, and we have received revenue and fiscal statements. There is no revenue impact on this bill and minimal fiscal impact.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Would you
for the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Examiners.
Okay.
I'm here this morning to request, in the name of the Board, a change to the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine. To do so, I need to give you just a little bit of history. The Board was established in 1927. At that time, it created and administered all licensing exams. Exams were required and have always been required for licensure. In 1980, as the profession was growing, it was determined that the board members' knowledge was fairly limited as far as creating exams. So the board contracted with the National Exam Service to create the exams. The board has continued to administer and administer these exams for a three-day period. In 1985, NPLEX, which is the National Naturopathic Physicians Licensing Exam, was created, which became the national standard for exams for naturopathic physicians in the United States. They created the exams, but the boards continue to administer these three-day exams, as well as our state jurisprudence and formulary exams for licensure. In about 2000, as more states got licensure, it's up to 20 states and jurisdictions now, there was the North American Board of Naturopathic Examiners was created to administer these NPLEX exams. This allowed consistency both in the exams and the administration and security of those exams. So the board still administers our own state jurisprudence and formulary exam, but we in general have turned over the responsibility of the creation of the national exams and to NPLEX and to NAPI. And that is the reason we are requesting the name change to Board of Naturopathic Medicine.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What other functions other than overseeing the exam does the board provide?
Currently?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, the board licenses all naturopathic physicians and regulates the practice of naturopathic medicine in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Ann.
Okay.
Rick, you're up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Marinelli. I'm the chair of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners. This is, in our view, kind of a modernization issue, in some ways a housekeeping name issue. As you know, the Board of Medical Examiners recently changed their name to the Oregon Board of Medicine in recognition that they no longer do examinations either. And because NPLEX, because national examinations are a very complex process, these tests have to be psychometrically validated. There's a lot of issues, and as Ann stated, the board of the, our local boards don't really have the expertise to generate and to oversee examinations of such complexity for the practice of medicine or the practice of naturopathic medicine. And so this is simply as a name change. If this is passed, then it will reflect what the board actually does, which is to regulate and oversee the practice of naturopathic medicine in Oregon.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It changes also in Section 1, goes from all members must be citizens to all members must be residents. Was that just an LC thing, or?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, yes, it was.
Other questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes, yes.
I have one.
Senator Verger.
You used a term that I'm just not familiar with, psychometrically something.
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger. Psychometric validation is the concept that tests have to be based on a job task analysis, and then those the questions that are on the exam actually have to relate to what that job function is. And there is, within the testing world, psychometric validation, meaning that your exam really is meaningful as applies to the practice of whatever it is that you're testing. In other words, you know, we're not going to get a test on something that doesn't really apply to our practice. And especially in light of the importance of an investment that people have in terms of going to school, paying tuition, spending years of their life studying something, if they feel that it's unfair and they sue a licensed, you know, whoever gives an exam, then if it's not psychometrically validated, then they're at risk for, you know, for winning their suit and the examining committee, you know, losing that. So that's my non-professional understanding of psychometric validation.
Thank you. It makes perfectly good sense. It was just a term that I was having trouble with understanding exactly what it meant. Thank you for the explanation.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on Senator Cruz's question. Regarding the residency requirement, my question is based on the fact that as a CPA, I know we're actually working towards crossing borders with reciprocity with our licensing, allowing CPAs to operate in the state of Oregon who don't live here but actually do work under Oregon law, et cetera, and vice versa. So what's the intent of limiting this to, this is just the board members need to be members or residents of the state?
Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, yes, that's, you can live in Washington and practice in Oregon as long as you have an Oregon license to practice as a naturopathic physician. That reference is to the board, composition of the board itself.
Just the board,
so
okay.
Our board members are actually residents.
Okay, good. Good question. Thank you very much. Others wishing? Thank you. Anything else? Nothing else? Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, I wasn't sure.
We will close the public hearing unless others are willing to testify. There's no one else signed up, and we will open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 131 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 131 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry the bill?
Sure.
Okay. The next bill that we're going to hear is... Here's my list. Senate Bill 132... do we sign up sheets? Looks like you're going to testify in Senate Bill 132 as well.
We are.
Good. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 132 increases the maximum civil penalty amount from $1,000 to $5,000 and makes housekeeping provisional revisions relating to the board's rulemaking authority. And there is no revenue or fiscal impact related to this bill.
And would you like to start?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Examiners and request your approval for this housekeeping bill, which will affect two pieces of our statute. The first piece is our civil penalty. In the 2007 legislature, we revised the civil penalty in 685-990 to $5,000. Inadvertently, the reference in 685-110 did not get changed to that amount. It was supposed to be $5,000 consistent throughout the statute, and that didn't happen. So we're just asking for that change. And then in 685-125, our rulemaking authority, the language has really been archaic, and we just saw this as an opportunity to use some plain language and make that a more readable statute. Have any questions?
No questions.
For the record, I'm Rick Marinelli. I'm the chair of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, and I also support this change, essentially making the statute consistent and updated. And I think that we're all interested in clearer language, which this would also afford us. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? No questions. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 132.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Any discussion? Objections? Okay. So moved. Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this bill?
Love to.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 327.
I do want to say I've had the informational hearing first. So
Okay. This will be an informational. We'll open an informational hearing that is related to this bill and other bills dealing with scope of practice. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale-Wood Village, and Fairview. That's Senate District 25. And we are going to spend about 10 minutes probably explaining to you how we got to the guidelines of scope of practice. As you know, the Senate passed Senate Bill 717, which would set up a process for any scope of practice to come before the body. And some organizations were very concerned that this was a conspiracy. It really wasn't a conspiracy. It really wanted to take the emotion and who's your best friend out of the process of making a decision regarding scope of practice. And so what we did over the interim, since the bill failed or didn't get anywhere in the House, we set up an interim committee. And we only had lobbyists. We said, okay, lobbyists, if you really feel strongly that this was a bad bill, let's have you come up with guidelines, with a process. And so this is what you're going to just get some highlights of what was the results of that interim committee made up. And I think you will have a handout that says of all of the organizations that were a part of developing the guidelines that this next bill that we will hear, Senate Bill 327, they have actually were the first people to say, let's try these guidelines, because I've made it voluntary. If you have a scope of practice change in my committee anyway, it would be nice for you to follow these guidelines. But this is your committee, Senator Morissette, but the naturopaths said that they wanted to follow this. And I'd like to turn it over to Sam Imperati, who was the facilitator for the group over the interim. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, good morning. Sam Imperati, I'm the Executive Director of the Institute for Conflict Management. I'm a mediator and public policy facilitator. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Oregon Consensus Program. You should have a PowerPoint to follow along. The Oregon Consensus Program facilitated the Human Health Scope of Practice Advisory Committee, which for shorthand we called the PAG. Oregon Consensus is the Oregon's program for public policy, consensus building, and conflict resolution. Its focus is to be a neutral forum for complex multi-party issues. It was established by the legislature in 1989 as part of the now-defunct Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. Its functions were transferred to Portland State University at the Hatfield School of Government. It's financed through a combination of state funding and fee-for-services. Here, members of the advisory group made contributions to fund this particular process. The personnel, it's directed by Elaine Hallmark. The project lead was Laurel Singer, and I was a contract facilitator. I'm here at the request of the committee to provide the PAG process background. I have no position, nor does the Oregon Consensus have any position on the bill before you. Contact information if you'd like further information. By way of background, you know that scope of practice regulations delimit the procedures that licensed health professionals can legally perform. Each session you receive numerous requests to change scopes, and proposed changes can trigger rather complex, time-consuming, and highly polarized conflicts. You face challenges in responding to those proposed changes in a manner that protects public safety. The Oregon Consensus Program did an assessment of some of the key stakeholders and determined that those stakeholders interviewed perceived that the current process for processing these scope changes were time-consuming, costly, inefficient, and tending to benefit the more influential stakeholders. The Oregon Consensus Program recommended that you convene a diverse stakeholder group to develop recommendations regarding criteria to process future scope requests. The PAG began its work in earnest in June of 2008. The goal was to recommend a pilot to you for this session. It delivered its final report in January of this year, and the project website is there for your reading pleasure. Here's a very easy to read list of participants in this august group. I could only get so many on a page. You have it there in written fashion, and there's a typo somewhere on the screen. You get a prize if you can find it. Here it is, another group of people. Time's up. We'll move on. The PAG process, these were a very, very dedicated group of diverse stakeholders. They met for four facilitated sessions, and we further explored these issues in an online survey fashion. They achieved a consensus recommendation, by and large, on almost all of the precepts for a legislatively funded pilot to process scope change requests using several recommended parameters. Those parameters included some of the following highlights: to limit the 2009 session pilot to human health-related issues as opposed to animal-related issues and other health-related.
Or CPAs.
CPAs, you're right. Lawyers were not exempt. I'm a lawyer. So, they recommended that you all base your decisions on 37 criterion in making these decisions. And here are some of the highlights. Identification of the articulated problem that the legislation is trying to solve, and evidence that the resolution will have a positive public health benefit. The impact of health care access, delivery, and costs based upon the change bill. Evidence-based review, including patient safety and risk-benefit analysis. Availability of education, testing, and regulation. And the advantages and disadvantages of potential overlapping scopes of practice. The PAG recommended that Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Greenlick should select several scope requests based upon the proposed criteria, that they utilize an impartial process to bring representatives together to complete a template and submit that report to you, to require all scope requests utilize this template, that it be because it uniformly addresses the issues that this group recommended are important. And then at the end, to have pilot participants and the PAG advisory group evaluate the pilot, report to you within 6 months of your adjournment to determine its effectiveness, its viability for any long-term bicameral and nonpartisan process to vet the scope practices you will receive undoubtedly in the future. So in conclusion of my presentation, again, the Oregon Consensus Program has no position on the applicability of PAG's recommendations to this bill, has no position on the bill's substance. We are neutral providers. We remain committed, however, to helping Oregonians agree, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Virgin.
Thank you. How many meetings did you have, and what was the cost?
I believe there were 4 half-day meetings, and a lot of work was done offline by using, I kid you not, a program called SurveyMonkey, where we poll members of the committee on their various preferences. I believe the cost was approximately $17,000, but I'm not positive. Do you know, Lori?
I thought it was $12,000, but it might have been $17,000.
Can we negotiate?
Yeah, that's right. I do have the budget with me, but it's in my office, and so I'd be able to get you that information. But what we did is we actually had the stakeholders put money into this program, and so it was not from the general fund. This was the stakeholders who actually funded this program.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I was intrigued by the number of people that you had as stakeholders so are on the committee. So I'm curious about the effectiveness of the surveying online and what you think of that process in dealing, for instance, in my district where I'm dealing with a number of people. Did you find that very effective, and do you find that effective in your work?
Senator, I find it very effective with an interested stakeholder group of professionals like we had here today. We used it not so much for the final decisions, but to prioritize the breadth of issues. And so it was used kind of as a synthesis tool to narrow down the ideas that were generated via brainstorming, narrow them down, prioritize them. Then those issues would come to the actual work group for the voting.
Mr. Chair, I think that an explanation, he was truly an excellent facilitator, and I think he needs to give himself more credit, because before we had these meetings, he came up with pages, I swear, of tentative possibility guidelines. He knows, as a facilitator, I don't know how he knew as much about scope as he did, but he did have an agenda, and as we went through, he had all stakeholders raise their hand with a 1 if they liked it, 2 if they didn't care, and 3 if they didn't like it. And it was very easy to process through these pages of issues that we were dealing with. So it was really quite effective, I felt.
Thank you. Were all of the stakeholders in the room at the same time?
No. The committee members ebbed and flowed depending on their availability and schedule.
So how many meetings did you have?
We had 4 basically half-day meetings, and then there was also polling done, again, via the survey.
Okay, so all of the stakeholders listed on this page had an opportunity. They all did weigh in on this?
They had an opportunity to weigh in. I can't say 100% certain that every single member of the stakeholder group said yes to every proposal. The actual count and the majority-minority reports and the consensus reports are in the report on a issue-by-issue basis.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't expect them all to say yes, but they all had an update. Did all of them participate?
Yes, in one form or another.
Either
in person or via SurveyMonkey. And they self-selected. We didn't limit the group. This was something unusual in public policy facilitation, where we usually try to look at a group of 15 to 30. We said, come all. Whoever would like to attend and feels they are an interested party, they are willing to participate. And then we had a secondary list of those who didn't want to participate per se but wanted to be kept abreast of what was going on. So they received the materials as well.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you in public?
We're
in public hearing.
We're in the information hearing.
Okay.
We'll go to the public hearing on the bill, right? Did you want to contribute more to the information?
I just wanted to thank the Portland Consensus Program and Sam Imperati and Laurel Singer and their staff for all the work that they put into this.
Okay. Now, are we going to hear about the guidelines at some point? Phil, are you going to talk about the guidelines? The multi-page?
The guidelines are, I can address that. The guidelines are what we, which was the consensus of the group, those are the guidelines that came forth to you. And I then submitted them to committee services, as well as letting stakeholders know that if there was anyone who would like to use these guidelines for their scope, to let me know. And so the guidelines, those are the guidelines that the group came up with.
Okay.
And the only changes is we didn't have a facilitator for the, if you see at the end, the agreements and disagreements. And I think that the naturopaths will address that issue. But do you have anything more to say?
Just very briefly, the criterion that the group recommended were divided into several contexts. The first was the historical context, asking about, again, the problem, proposed changes, how does it address health care needs. The second section addressed education and training, what are the requirements, what are the entry-level requirements, what are the competency measures available. The third section and dealt with evidence, what evidence within the profession relates to the particular procedures and skills, what is the evidence that the procedure skill is beneficial, what does the literature review say. The next is regulatory environment, looking at whether or not the regulatory board or licensing entity was capable of protecting public and regulating the proposed practice changes, the minimum insurance requirements, and then there were additional factors about supervision and overall impact on health care costs. So it went through, again, 37 separate criteria. The committee said on balance was a fair way to look at these particular proposed changes and all, and inclusive, so you'd have a balanced presentation.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Bridger.
I just want to make a comment because as an elected official, I have found it very frustrating. Every session we have people coming to us, and it means moving their scope wider, and it's very hard and very difficult, I think, to sit and listen and make those decisions. And so I think that you've really really been very helpful in setting up some kind of guidelines, and I just want to thank you and thank Senator Monta Sanderson, because I know your leadership was provided.
Mm-hmm. Excellent leadership on your part. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Monta Sanderson. Thank you. Okay, we close the information hearing, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 327. Phil, and Senator Bridger, this is going to be a different kind of a scope of practice change. Instead of making it wider, they're going to make it narrower.
Narrower.
No? 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 Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 327 permits the Council on Naturopathic Physicians to determine the drugs that a naturopathic physician may not prescribe and to establish a formulary of the prohibited drugs. The provision would apply only to drugs prescribed or administered on or after January 1st, 2010, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay. Phil.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Isn't that music to your ears to hear that this legislation has no fiscal? And,
and I'm a little bit confused about broadening or narrowing the scope.
I better cut to the chase then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, for nearly a century, naturopathic physicians have had prescribing authority in the state of Oregon. Existing statutory authority that you find in today's statute dates back to 1953. And in 1989, a formulary was established that allowed naturopathic physicians to prescribe across all classes of medications everything that was naturally derived. In other words, it had to be it was based on its molecular structure. If it could be determined to be naturally derived, then it was okay for the naturopathic formulary to approve the use of that prescription drug. So you've had that existing. You've had a formulary list right now that's some 1,000 different medications. And the Board of Naturopathic Physicians, along with the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, have been considering a change to allow prescribing authority to drugs that are synthetically derived, because that's essentially you've got things that are naturally derived and you have things that are synthetically derived. And we believe that such a change is in the best interest of this state because it will provide more and better health care options for Oregonians. So what you see before you is Senate Bill 327. And I've circulated a section-by-section description of the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think, Mr. Donovan, you need to clarify that naturopaths can only prescribe medications that are naturally derived.
That is exactly the case.
Correct. Yeah.
And just to, I'll jump ahead just a little bit.
Okay.
Before you is this bound document. If you were to flip to Appendix B, page 30, you'll see there all of the different medications that can be prescribed by a naturopathic physician. So pages 30, 31, 32, through page 35. Those are all the medications that, under existing law, a naturopathic physician can prescribe. They're all naturally derived. Mm-hmm. What I was referring to then with regards to the section-by-section description of the bill, as you know, when you make any change to a statutory definition, what seemed like a simple change becomes a bit more complex. And so each of the sections are broken down in this guide so you can follow at the point of which you make a change and make it so that a naturopathic physician can prescribe a synthetic drug, it creates tremendous reorganization. Now, by the way, we worked with legislative counsel to get this legislation drafted, and we think that the reorganization that legislative counsel suggested is very, very good. So as you've heard from Sam and Senator Montes Anderson, scope of practice issues have vexed the legislature. Instead of considering what is necessarily best for healthcare consumers and ensures the best public safety, the debate too often is degenerated into who can generate the most emails and phone calls. So as the Senate considered a more defined process for consideration of scope of practice issues, we took keen interest. In fact, I'll point out that the legislation that was introduced last session by Senator Montes Anderson, we opposed initially. And our concern at that time was too much of your legislative authority was getting pushed aside. Frankly, Oregon's naturopathic laws are some of the best in the nation. And you, the Oregon legislature, are to thank for that. So we wanted to make sure that the legislature's role was maintained, and we think that this process, this template, really helps arrive at that. Now, we think you're on the right path. We think that changes in practice need to be based on education, training, the public safety, and not on turf wars. So in front of you, and what you're all referring to right now, is a 40-plus page document that responds to the questions posed in the template that Sam just briefed you on. And there's a lot to consider here, and we hope that our testimony today is organized so that we can verbally summarize what's found within. As we are the first to undergo this process. We feel like we're a bit of a guinea pig here. And I think the main message I want to share with you, the committee, and to the other stakeholders who are monitoring this legislation is that we are committed to helping bring clarity to this issue so that everybody can be well assured that this is a public policy change that's in the public's interest. So if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce individuals who we have prepared to walk you through this document. And then what I'd like to request is at the end of today's public testimony, if you might be able to bring me back up so that we can discuss what appropriate next steps would be for this legislation. So with that, arranged for four individuals to verbally summarize the document. The first, to provide the historical context, where have we been, where are we going, is Dr. Rick Marnelli, who is on the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners and a member of the Formulary Council. We have Dr. Rita Bettenberg, who is with the National College of Natural Medicine, which is based in Portland, and she will be here to share the doctoral program that naturopathic physicians receive and a kind of in-depth discussion of the education and training that they receive. Ann Walsh, who you heard from earlier, who will talk about the regulatory environment. And finally, Laura Farr, to provide our professional association's viewpoint. So with that, I would close, Mr. Chair, and hope that you would invite these witnesses to come share with you what's in here so you don't all have to read this word for word.
Dr. Marinelli and Dr. Bettenberg, would you please come up?
Well, good morning again, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. Thank you for your time and attention today on this initial hearing of Senate Bill 327. As you know, I'm Rick Marinelli. I'm a naturopathic physician and acupuncturist. I practice primary and specialty care in Portland, Oregon. I'm the current chair of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners. I am a member of the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council, and I'm also a commissioner of the Oregon Pain Management Commission. I'm here today to give you some historical insight to naturopathic physician prescribing. You heard Phil Donovan say the initial prescriptive authority and minor surgical privileges were legislated initially in the 1950s. The Naturopathic Formulary, the Physicians Formulary Council, which manages the present inclusionary formulary, was established 20 years ago by this body. The present Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council membership is comprised of pharmacists, pharmacologists, a medical doctor, and two naturopathic physicians who decide what drugs to include, hence the inclusionary formulary, based on natural structure under the naturopathic formulary. Currently, well over 1,000 drugs from every major therapeutic category are included in this formulary, which naturopathic physicians have safely and efficaciously used this formulary for two decades with a few significant problematic issues. The first and foremost issue, I believe, is one of public safety. And I hope that becomes really clear as I describe this, because I think that's really the primary concern. It was for this reason that in November of 2004, the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council expressed in a letter to the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners unanimous support for statutory change in order to allow the inclusion of synthetic substances into the naturopathic formulary. To improve the public safety and prescribing efficacy. That may be a little surprising, from coming from a naturopathic physician, that we're advocating for a synthetic substance versus natural, but I'd like to give you the insight of a very important study that was published a few years ago. This is the ALLHAT study. This was the study found, it was looking at the reduction of heart attack, stroke, and heart failure from hypertension. What this study found was that the most safe, efficacious, and economical medication was a thiazide diuretic, HCTZ, hydrochlorothiazide. Comparing it to a natural calcium channel blocker and an ACE inhibitor, curiously, both the calcium channel blockers and the ACE inhibitors are included in our formulary because they're naturally derived substances. However, thiazide diuretics are not, and this had been submitted to us repeatedly by doctors saying, look, we know about this study, we want to be able to prescribe thiazide diuretics for our patients because we know this is the safest, most efficacious, most economical drug to prescribe. But the formulary council was unable to approve this because the statute did not allow for this to occur. There are many other examples where a synthetically derived drug is safer, more efficacious, and economical than one that is naturally derived. Other problems that the current inclusionary formulary creates includes confusion for naturopathic physicians, pharmacists, and patients, as well as health administrators, about what is and what is not included in the formulary. This is due to the unusual construct within pharmacy views of substances being organized according to natural substance relationships versus pharmacological therapeutic categories. And I'm not sure that that you can appreciate how difficult that is for many folks. You have one system that's based on biochemical structure and one that everyone else looks at, which is the pharmacological category. So this has been a nightmare for pharmacists. It's been very challenging for practitioners. I get calls all the time about, is this on the formulary? Or is it not on the formulary, even though we have our entire formulary published on the website in two different formats, as a list and as a by category. The problem is that whole categories of medications, it sometimes is not clear as whether it is a certain drug is in that category, because that's not the way it's been categorized. Another significant problem is the overall increase in healthcare costs this inclusionary formulary engenders. Healthcare costs are increased by patients having to see another provider to manage or obtain a medication that is within the expertise of naturopathic physicians to prescribe. It is irrational that naturopathic physicians can prescribe methadone, which is a very complex drug to prescribe, but not a thiazide diuretic, which is inexpensive, safe, and, you know, doesn't take a lot of skill to prescribe. Costs are also increased when naturopathic physicians are limited from becoming primary care providers in public health or in underserved areas, essentially limiting health care access due to limitations in the formulary. And you'll hear more stories about that this morning, how naturopathic physicians are ready, able, and willing to fill these slots in places where there's a definite need. But because of this formulary issue, they're not suitable for employment in that regard. Other states, including Arizona, Vermont, and Washington, have recognized that naturopathic physicians have the appropriate training for an exclusionary formulary. If Senate Bill 327 becomes statute, the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council that I mentioned the membership of previously will continue to oversee the formulary and decide what drugs will be excluded. Hence the name exclusionary formulary. This change will make the naturopathic formulary safer, more efficacious, and economical. This change also has the potential to improve healthcare access for the underserved, improve public health by increasing the number of naturopathic physicians in true primary care roles, and to substantially lower costs through elimination of duplication of services, more rational prescribing, and greater overall efficiency of the healthcare delivery system. I appreciate your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Marinelli, your role on the Pain Commission, what types of drugs can you currently prescribe for pain?
Mr. Chair, our formulary presently includes all the Schedule II opioid pain medications. So this is everything from, all the analogs of opium, which are hydrocodone, okay, hydromorphone, methadone, oxycodone. And we've had that prescribing privilege for decades.
Now, with this change, what other drugs might you... But that's to be decided by the board, which drugs may be added to that?
Which drugs... Actually, as far as I know, there are no other opioid drugs. We already have all those on.
Well, there are no other drugs besides the opioid drugs that you in Schedule 2?
In Schedule 2, we already have all of those, okay, Schedule 2 drugs included in our formulary. Okay. And we have other scheduled drugs in the formulary as well. In fact, we have drugs from all Schedules 2 through 5 currently. What this would, this change would allow is for the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council to decide which drugs, rather than what drugs they want to include, which drugs they want to exclude. Okay. A few efficiencies occur with this. One thing is that new medications are coming out regularly, and so do you want to wait 6 months to have this included? Well, in this case, the formulary council could decide if it was appropriate or not. I think that the primary change happens with drugs that are really essentially considered primary care drugs that would be included, unless the formulary council decided that they shouldn't be. And the best, I think the best association to look at this is the nurse practitioner formulary. Nurse practitioners have an exclusionary formulary that the board or the Oregon Board of Nursing decides which medications are not included. And essentially, they're considered mid-level prescribers. We're considered mid-level prescribers. This essentially would make our formulary like the nurse practitioner formulary.
Senator Mona Sanderson?
Yes, I was just going to bring that up. It's on page, I forget which page, that shows comparing the training for nurse practitioners. It's on page, it doesn't have a page. It's page 8. And it's interesting to see that actually the naturopaths have more hours of training than nurse practitioners actually do in pharmacology. But my question was more on, could you cite what drugs you would exclude? I know that all the drugs go through extensive testing, research, and then clinical trials. And I want to know what the relationship of the people on your formulary council would have on what drugs you see that they would exclude.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mons Anderson, thank you for that question. That is really something that the Naturopathic Formulary Physicians Council would have to decide. And actually, there are several members here today, so you could ask them that question also. My response would be, it's likely that we would exclude drugs that that really are not generally considered within the scope of naturopathic practice. This might include the chemotherapy drugs as a beginning. Some drugs, and there's actually a long list of those substances that, surprisingly, most of them are naturally occurring molecules. And no one's submitted those in the past, and I think that the formulary council may or may not consider those appropriate. My sense is that they would not. I also think that medications that are generally used in strictly hospital-based practice may be excluded. Again, if we take our lead from the nurse practitioner formulary, they have a list, and mostly it are those kinds of medications. Actually, I think that they have chemotherapy drugs on theirs, but they do have excluded certain hospital-based medications.
And just follow up?
Yes.
I'm a nurse, so I'm pretty in tune to the medical model, and never really knew much about naturopaths until one of my employees at Clackamas County Public Health was telling me about her naturopathic physician and how it had truly, truly made a difference in her life. I am just curious if naturopathic physicians, they're known to not want to prescribe meds if at all possible, that they want to go the natural way. And so can you give some reason why, well, obviously the telling reason was your cardiac drug, furosemide and HCTZ, hydrochlorothiazide, is been known and around and used forever, but is there a tendency for naturopathic physicians to want to prescribe more, or is this just a tool?
Mr. Chair, Senator Amon Sanderson, again, thank you for that question. At our December Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians annual meeting, pharmacy meeting, where we have mostly pharmacy instruction, we did a little survey that actually asked about prescribing habits of naturopathic physicians, and it was not surprising to me that most naturopathic physicians are not big prescribers. In fact, I think that your assessment that naturopathic physicians, you know, generally would like rather not to prescribe is true. I think that naturopathic physicians are also pragmatists in some, in many situations, understand the absolute need. For example, the thiazide diuretic example that I gave, and the reduction of heart failure, heart attack, and stroke from hypertension. The average naturopathic physician in our survey prescribe 10 medications or less per month, and most of them did not have significant controlled substance prescriptions within those RXs. So I think that my perspective on this is that it will enable naturopathic physicians to prescribe probably very conservatively and when appropriate. I can tell you as the chair of the board is that we have very few complaints relatively about prescribing, and especially about inappropriate prescribing. It's almost always, you know, prescribing off the formulary or some sort of problem with charting and management of pain medications, which is problematic for most people. So I would anticipate that naturopathic physicians would use this as an opportunity to actually do more preventive care in public health settings and in underserved areas, as opposed to becoming the new generation of prescribers.
And another follow-up?
Yes.
Regarding billing. We have a formulary here I think it's a wonderful formulary, and you fall under those guidelines, so that if you prescribe a drug, it needs to go to the generic. You know, just tell me how you fit into that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monos Anderson, again, thank you. Right now, and included in the pamphlet that you got, or rather small book is probably more like it, there's an article, there's an abstract that I found on from Pharmacoeconomics that essentially is talking about the use of formulary to help control costs, not just necessarily prescribing cheaper drugs, but prescribing generics when possible, but also when prescribing drugs that are known to be efficacious, and the research shows that in this case, again, the All Hat study example is an excellent one, where thiazide is a very inexpensive drug, where the ACE inhibitors and the calcium channel blockers are not. In this case, allowing naturopathic physicians to prescribe rationally versus a kind of artificial separation between natural and synthetic, and just choosing the best medication, would make for more economic choices as well as for better and safer and more efficacious choices in prescribing. I hope I answered your question.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Bettenberg.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I'm here to talk about education. I'm Dr. Rita Bettenberg. I'm the Dean of the Naturopathic Program at the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland. I graduated from there in 1989. I did a primary care residency, and have been a faculty member at the college and since that time. I maintain a very small private practice in Portland, and I'm also currently serving on the Council for Naturopathic Medical Education, which is the federal accrediting body for naturopathic college programs. The overview of the program, the naturopathic program at NCNM is the oldest in the country. It requires 4,620 hours of education, which includes about 1,548 hours of direct clinical exposure. This is comparable to educational requirements of other naturopathic colleges as well as other medical schools. It's a four-year in-residence program. Admissions, the requirements to become admitted are similar for any medical program. It requires a bachelor's degree from an accredited college, as well as a list of scientific and social science prerequisites in addition to that degree. The first 2 years of classroom education are biomedical sciences. This means anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, embryology, the list of ologies. It also includes pathology and the beginnings of diagnostic evaluation of patients. This human physical science foundation is then followed mostly in the second year by a more extensive study in diagnostic procedures, physical examination, laboratory analysis, laboratory diagnosis, diagnostic imaging, those sorts of things. Again, very similar to what any medical school will be utilizing. Success in measuring this material is measured by the Biomedical Sciences National Board exams. These can be taken after the student's second year of school, if they so desire. The second 2 years of the program are focused on translating this biomedical science and diagnostic knowledge into clinical application. The clinical sciences include specific courses in all the different organ systems of the body, cardiology, pulmonology, that sort of thing, in order to provide a framework of diagnostic and therapeutic education about the that's needed for a primary care physician. They take concurrent courses in disease management, disease prevention, and therapeutic modalities that they're taught in those second 2 years include nutrition, botanical medicines, physical medicine, homeopathy, lifestyle counseling, minor surgery, and of course pharmacology as examples. The diagnostic and treatment skills are developed and assessed in their student clinical rotations by faculty. The faculty in the program are required by Oregon law to have a terminal degree in the discipline that they teach, so anatomy is taught by a PhD in anatomy, etc. The curriculum is assessed and updated regularly by an in-house curriculum committee. This is mandated by our federal accreditors, and every change in the committee, or every change in the curriculum, will go through that committee. Both course content and also integration of didactic materials into clinical education are addressed in this committee. And the committee will assess changes in curriculum and indeed sometimes mandate changes in curriculum in response to information gathered by alumni surveys as to what areas they needed more work in. Also, licensing laws in the various states will have an impact on our curriculum content in some cases, and any advances in medicine will often change curricular content. The pharmacological education that our students experience is fairly extensive because interventions by naturopathic physicians will include the use of pharmaceutical or drug therapy when appropriate. Naturopathic medical students are required to learn about all the classes of pharmacological agents, regardless of whether or not they can prescribe them under Oregon law. The current program includes 72 hours of classroom education, which describes the principles of pharmacodynamics, side effects of drugs, therapeutic uses of legend or prescription drugs. And this compares very favorably with the other professions that are able to prescribe legend drugs. Additional emphasis is currently given at NCNM on drugs that are on the naturopathic formulary in Oregon, but we're not restricted to that because, as was you heard earlier, the drugs on the current formulary cross all lines of drug classes, and so they need to learn about everything. Students are exposed routinely in their clinical training to the appropriate selection, prescription, and management of prescription drug use. Their clinical rotations provide practical management experience with patients. The students are exposed to a wide variety of patient populations, and this is one area where this change in the formulary is probably very significant. It is true that many patients will go to a naturopathic physician because they want to avoid taking drugs that have side effects, or they want to avoid a chemical treatment in preference of a natural treatment. But the reality is that very often the best thing for them at that time is a drug treatment. Naturopathic physicians are trained to recognize indications, efficacy, and potential side effects of drugs, whether they can prescribe them or not, because the fact is that many of the patients come in on those drugs, and they need to know about the drug that that patient is on. So even if we can't prescribe it, we have to learn about it and understand what it does to the patient and what the indications are for it. In the teaching clinics at NCNM and all the other colleges too, assessment of the patient history includes an evaluation of all pharmacological treatment that patient has been on. In some clinics, most notably our acute care community-based clinics, where we treat patients who have no health insurance and are basically are medically underserved, we get a cross-section of the population that may not be choosing naturopathic care, but they just need someone to take care of them. And in this case, having access to all possible drugs for a certain condition on an outpatient basis would be extremely useful, because these patients are not necessarily wanting herbs. They just want the correct antibiotic for what it is that they're suffering from. Under the current formulary, there are also times when a patient really needs to discontinue a medication. They go and see a naturopathic physician. That physician cannot discontinue that medication, because we cannot discontinue something that we can't prescribe. And so then this requires the patient to go find a doctor who can prescribe that medication in order to discontinue it, unless they just quit taking it, which isn't always a good decision for patients to make on their own. Program accreditation has pretty much the same as any school in Oregon in terms of the amount of federal oversight. The programs in naturopathic medical schools are subject to federal Department of Education oversight through the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education, also called CNME. This is the accrediting agency that monitors all naturopathic programs in the U.S. and Canada according to federal guidelines. The CNME standards for student include many layers of the educational process, including curriculum, delivery of curriculum, performance outcomes, financial stability of the college, student services, college board function, and professional success of the graduates. The process is rigorous. It is an ongoing. We're always involved in some kind of accreditation reporting or changing or changes. There's annual reports. There are self-studies that occur where the college evaluates their entire function, and a team from the accrediting agent comes on campus to evaluate that process. All colleges in Oregon also, including OHSU, are overseen by what is known as the regional accreditor. The regional accreditor in Oregon is the Northwest Consortium of Colleges and Universities. This group accredits the institution as a whole. The CNME that I just mentioned earlier focuses most completely on the specific program. So any university might have their regional accreditor and then dozens of different programmatic accreditors that are all licensed by the Department of Education. Licensed jurisdictions in the United States and Canada all require that a student or a graduate pass a biomedical sciences exam as well as a clinical sciences exam. This is the NPLEX that was mentioned earlier. The exam is rigorous. Roughly 75% of people pass it the first time. It undergoes extensive evaluation, as was discussed earlier. And also, all licensed jurisdictions in the U.S. and Canada require that a student graduate from a CNME-accredited college. So the licensing bodies recognize that as being a stamp of a quality school. Currently, the examinations, I just wanted to mention, have been modified, and they consist of questions that are in a very integrated format that require demonstration of critical clinical thinking. They're not just memorizing data. It's to actually have to actually evaluate and clinically assess cases. Lastly, I want to mention residencies in naturopathic medicine, because this does often come up. Certified postgraduate residency opportunities are available at all naturopathic colleges. Some of these occur on-site at the colleges and the clinics there. Some are provided through partnerships with medical clinics and practitioners around the country. They are structured, competency-based, supervised programs that provide an in-depth experience in areas of interest for the postgraduate student, as well as teaching skills that they learn at some of the sites. And the point is to broaden and deepen the clinical education of the resident, provide experience for them in medical research facilities, and opportunities for becoming more skilled in specific areas of specialization that they did not get in their basic program. Currently, all graduates do not have access to a residency. There aren't enough of them. Medical doctors have access to federal and state funding that support their residency programs. Naturopathic colleges do not have that access. Without that kind of funding, it is unlikely that medical doctors would have residencies available too. Our residencies for the naturopathic physicians are based on the ability of colleges to pay for those residencies, for the profession itself to subsidize those residencies, and that is a limited market. The goal of the colleges right now is to provide a high-quality graduate education program for all graduates, but likely resolution of the funding problem will be necessary before this can happen. The American Association of Naturopathic Medical Colleges identifies this as a high priority for the future. I would like to conclude by saying that the educational program in naturopathic medical colleges does prepare graduates to appropriately prescribe and manage prescription drug use. State licensing bodies require the physicians to be up to date in their prescribing skills through focused continuing medical education requirements, and also through oversight of the use of prescriptive authority by licensed physicians. A rational and clear exclusionary formula will benefit Oregonians and allow more economic and patient-centered health care delivery. I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Question? Okay. Thank you. Ann Walsh and Laura Farr, would you come up, please?
Oops.
Good morning, Chair Morissette.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. I'm Ann Walsh, the Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Examiners. I'm here to support the OAMP's Senate Bill 327. It is an issue that the Board has looked at with the Professional Association for many years, and I do know that in past sessions their legislation has been tried to be passed, but I think there was not the cooperation or the work done prior to session to make it a viable cooperative bill. I think the Professional Association has done a great job working with this bill. As far as regulating the scope change, the board is very capable of doing that. Naturopaths have been prescribing since at least 1950, and the board has been regulating that practice since 1927. So as far as discipline goes, we have all the tools we need. We regulate it. We require continuing education every year. And of that, 25 hours every year, at least 5 of it has to be in pharmacy. So from the time they get a license, they have to do pharmacy every year. They're continually being required to educate themselves on pharmacology. As far as the discipline, and I did a little bit of researching, and prescribing complaints over the last 2 to 3 biennium have been anywhere from 5 to 3 cases in a biennium, and of those, maybe 2 require discipline. The basic premise for the violation is prescribing off the formulary. In some cases, it's a case of the doctor didn't know, and it was what the patient needed. In a couple of cases, it was prescribing, over-prescribing for a patient who was on medication, and the ND over-prescribed. And most discipline turns to education. We require additional education or civil penalties. If it comes to it, we will require a practitioner to provide all prescriptions written, a record to us on a bimonthly basis that is tracked by an investigator.
I have my budget hearing is in hearing room F, so I'm trying to get you what I need. And I don't want to miss anything, because I think it's really an important piece that you understand the board is capable and has discipline. Do you have any questions at this time?
Mr. Chair, she can hurry and go to the other hearing room. We have good doctors, bad doctors. We have good nurses, bad doctors. I'm sure we have good naturopaths, bad naturopaths. And I'm glad to hear that you probably have a lot fewer maybe complaints than the other organizations. But what I want to know is, I don't question the training that we get here, but when we have some naturopath from another state or another country, how are they dealt with? How do they become licensed?
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, a naturopath that's licensed in Oregon meets a standard, and that standard requires them to have graduated from an accredited naturopathic medical college. And so we know, because that program's accredited, we know that their education is very specific to, very standardized. They also must pass the NPLEX exams, which is the nationally recognized exams for naturopathic physicians. So if they've met those two criteria, they then have to pass our own state jurisprudence and formulary exam, which also questions them on that prescriptive process as well.
So it's actually easier for a nurse to come, because I was trained actually in Virginia, and State of Oregon just accepted my nursing license, and all I had to do was say, here I am, and I didn't have to take any other tests, which was quite nice.
Likely.
Thank you.
So. Any other questions for me at this time?
I certainly am
willing to come back if there are further questions of me. If we don't get our budget passed, it doesn't matter what we do.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Laura?
Senator Morissette, thank you for inviting us all here today and members of the committee. My name is Laura Culberson Farr. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And the OANP, just like our colleagues with the Oregon Medical Association, we exist to support naturopathic physicians and the practice of naturopathic medicine. Because of the rapid growth in naturopathic medicine, a lot of people tend to think of this profession as something that's fashionable or somewhat trendy. And I'd like to point out, our growth has been so rapid that the current enrollment for the student body at the National College of Natural Medicine, they just changed their name, in Portland, is roughly approximately the same as that of OHSU's medical student enrollment. So this is a rapidly growing profession. However, the practice of naturopathic medicine is as old as the state of Oregon itself, and our association just celebrated its 100th year anniversary last Friday, the day before Oregon's sesquicentennial. In surveys that we conducted of our membership, modernizing the ND formulary to include all pharmaceuticals used in a primary care setting is on the top three issues that our members request us to address. And I have seen a little bit of head-scratching still about the difference between an inclusionary formulary versus an exclusionary formula, and I want to make sure that I address that the request that's before you today, we can already prescribe all naturally derived pharmaceuticals. The request that this bill addresses is to include synthetically derived pharmaceuticals as prescribing authority for naturopathic physicians. I want to reiterate again, too, that this bill is not a request to authorize a new skill or a new way of practicing. I was reluctant to engage originally in this scope of practice review process because it's not really a change to our scope of practice. Naturopathic physicians have been practicing primary care for over 100 years, and we've been prescribing from every class of pharmaceutical drug for decades. So we have the skills. We know how to do this. We know how to assess, how to write the script, how to figure out the dosage, what the interactions are between the various drugs. This is a bill to update a definition that was created in the 1950s. Pure and simple. It's to modernize it to reflect current medical standards of care, to reflect the advances in modern medicine with advances in new pharmaceuticals that have hit the market, and to reflect the increasing healthcare needs of our population. This is also a bill to address the calls that we get every week in our office, mostly from patients who ask for often a naturopathic doctor who is also licensed as a medical doctor, because what they want is a naturopathic doctor to manage all of their health care needs, but they need often a medical doctor to be able to prescribe the prescriptions that they're already on. This is a bill to address the calls that we get from medical doctors in the community who are frustrated that they would like to hire a naturopathic doctor into their clinics, but they can't because of the limitations on the formulary that we can't prescribe these sometimes simple synthetic drugs. And I'd like to draw your attention to page 37 of this document, which is a letter from a clinic here in Salem. Page 37. This is a nonprofit clinic with nonprofit size salaries, but a huge caseload. They primarily treat migrant, legal, and illegal migrant Hispanic workers in the Salem area. They already have two naturopathic doctors on staff. They've recently had the funds to hire more doctors to provide relief for those on staff and to be able to serve more people. But they could not find a medical doctor to fill those positions. They had several naturopathic applicants, but they wouldn't hire them because that would require the already overworked MDs on staff to co-manage those patients who need synthetic drugs to be prescribed. And the medical doctors on staff don't have time to do that. Those positions went unfilled, which means that those patients are not getting access to health care that they need. This is a bill to address the calls that we get from naturopathic physicians, primarily in rural communities, who are at wit's end when they have to refer one of their patients to a medical doctor just to get a prescription filled. And I have one particular example of a naturopathic doctor who had to refer his patient out for a prescription. Days later, after the appointment with the naturopathic doctor, the patient called with an acute problem. And when the ND asked if the medical doctor had actually written the prescription, the response was no, because I couldn't get an appointment with my medical doctor until 3 weeks from now. And that person was in had an acute problem, and the naturopathic doctor had to send them to the emergency room to be able to get the prescription that they needed for their problem. I want to remind you that these are primary care doctors who have had 4, 5, or sometimes 6 years of training in a medical school, depending on what program they're in. They've had more hours of pharmacology, as Senator Monis Anderson has alluded to on the chart on page 8, during their schooling than medical students at OHSU and nurse practitioners. They already have the authority to prescribe pharmaceuticals from every class of drugs. They simply can't prescribe those few that happen to have a synthetic molecular structure. The definition of naturally derived is simply outdated and doesn't work anymore. It's already been alluded to that this is happening in other states. Washington, Arizona, and Vermont have already expanded their scopes of prescription authority for naturopathic physicians to include everything that you would use in a primary care setting. I hope that you will all see this bill, as we do, as an easy solution to help Oregon address the crisis that we have in primary care physicians, and also as a solution to help decrease the cost of health care. It's ridiculous that we have to send patients out to another practitioner just to get a prescription filled, and they incur the commensurate costs of that additional office visit, which increases the cost of the overall health care system. We've got a trained pool of primary care naturopathic doctors who are ready to fill those community clinic positions that are currently going unfilled. While I was reluctant to engage in the scope of practice review process initially, I have found that it has been a gratifying experience. It's been an exciting opportunity to educate our colleagues in other professions. And I'm eager to continue the discussion with a little bit of guidance from you and your continued support. And hopefully we'll get some further clarification from all of you members of the committee and other stakeholders about where we need to go next with this bill. Thank you for your time.
Any guidance from the committee? Senator Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the salary of a naturopathic physician in, say, a clinic, versus a nurse practitioner versus a physician?
Do
Dr. Schumacher,
well,
can you?
Yeah. No, you have,
you
to,
have
come
to
up.
Come up to the microphone.
Yeah. And introduce yourself, please, for the record.
For the record, my name is Dr. Julie Chinnock. I work at Outside In Clinic, which is a homeless medical clinic in downtown Portland. And this issue of the formulary has been one that's come up in regards to my salary. We make approximately 60 to 75% of the salary of a medical doctor that works in the same position that I do at that clinic. We don't have any nurse practitioners on staff, but we are considering hiring one. The argument that was used to pay us at the rate of 60 to 75% of the medical doctor was that they were trying to make a comparison of our formulary, saying that we are able to prescribe approximately 60 to 75% of the full formulary of a medical doctor in Oregon. So that's the rationale that was used. In private practice, it's different, and it really depends on reimbursement from third-party payers and out-of-pocket expenses. But in a community clinic, at least the one that I work in, that's what we make.
Let's follow up.
Yes.
Can you just give an example of a third-party payer, what you get? Does it just depend on the contracts that are set up?
My clinic's a little bit different because we don't accept private insurance at that clinic. It's for underinsured and uninsured patients, but maybe somebody else could.
Senator Morissette, Senator Monacy-Anderson, we haven't pulled this, but I believe that the residents receive a salary of roughly $30,000 to $33,000 per year, and in private practice, a practitioner can assume a salary of anywhere between $20,000 per year if they're working part-time to upwards of over $100,000. So it really ranges quite dramatically. But naturopathic physicians typically open their own clinics or get hired on by already established clinics. They are not hired. This is changing. But they are not typically hired into, for example, hospital settings or other established medical doctor clinics where there's a set salary range. They typically are responsible for raising their own salaries.
Do you have any idea how the approval of this bill and expanding the formulary would affect the relative number of prescriptions you will be able to write in comparison to an MD? The salary was set based on the limited number of prescriptions, right?
That was one of the key factors.
One of the key factors. Okay, if this bill is passed and you don't know how broadly you will expand your formulary?
That's partly correct, Senator Morissette. We anticipate that the formulary would be expanded certainly to include all pharmaceuticals that would be prescribed in a primary care setting. It does have yet to be determined, and it will be determined by the Formulary Council of Naturopathic Physicians, what the criteria will be for which drugs to exclude from the formulary, and that process hasn't yet been initiated.
So it will have some impact on the pace, the comparative prescription writing of the two disciplines. Yeah.
Definitely it will have some impact, and they will likely become more similar, and Senator Monacy-Anderson alluded, and Dr. Marinelli alluded, it would probably be most similar to the formulary of the nurse practitioners.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. Kathy Ruckers.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair and committee members. I'm Kathy Rakers. I'm a registered pharmacist here in the state of Oregon and a member of the Naturopathic Formulary Committee. I've been a pharmacist here for 17 years, and I've served on the committee for 8 years. And I've worked side-by-side with naturopathic doctors in my practice settings. For 4 years I did that, and I'm also a patient of naturopathic physicians. So I kind of come to this in support of Senate Bill 327 from a lot of different aspects. Primarily, in my experience as a pharmacist, I look at the formulary as having some kind of critical medications that are excluded from it, at the present time. Like Dr. Marinelli and others mentioned, the hydrochlorothiazide, the furosemide, there are some diabetes drugs that are lacking from the formulary that are commonly prescribed and very inexpensive. There are many mental health medications that aren't on the formulary currently, addiction, withdrawal medications that can be very important for our special needs populations here in Oregon that are not currently on the formulary. So I would like to see the formulary expanded and to become an exclusionary formulary for these reasons primarily. I think that the formulary as it exists now, it limits patients' freedom of choice. I mean, if I want to see one doctor, I'd like the naturopathic doctor to be able to do everything that I need him or her to do for me. I feel like in rural settings where there may not be access or medical doctors or nurse practitioners available in a timely manner, I feel it can be very, it's very important to have this expanded formulary so that needs are met in a timely manner for patients. Also, just addressing the drugs that already exist on the formulary, we already have many medications, as Dr. Marinelli said, that are difficult to prescribe. They have a narrow therapeutic index, meaning their potential for toxicity is great. I've seen these drugs prescribed inappropriate and very just intellectual ways. I mean, I haven't seen any problems in my practice settings with the prescribing of these potentially dangerous, potentially harmful, potentially interactive medications. So I would like to continue to see more medications prescribed and continue to just help patients and practitioners and our kind of struggling healthcare system here in Oregon and the struggle of the healthcare system in the rest of the United States. Thanks very much. Oh, any questions?
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Walls, would you come up, please?
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is David Walls. I'm the Executive Director with the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. We've submitted some testimony from the United Medical Lobby. This is a group of professional medical associations consisting of the Oregon Medical Association, the Osteopathic Physicians, and several specialty physician associations. You can go ahead and read that testimony. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon today. Osteopathic physicians are complete physicians. They're also called the DOs, similar to allopathic physicians or MDs. They go through many of the same training requirements that includes an undergraduate degree with a focus on basic sciences, completion of the medical college admissions test, 4 years of osteopathic medical school, and the 4 years of schooling include 2 years of classroom training, 2 years of clinical training in clinical rotations through certified preceptors. Osteopathic physicians can either take the USMLE, which is United States Licensing Medical Examination, or they can take the COMLEX, which is the Comprehensive Osteopathic Medical Examination. This examination is a three-step examination taken throughout their education. The first step includes a test of their knowledge of their basic sciences. The step two includes the testing of their knowledge in the clinical sciences. And the important step, or most important, step three of the USMLE or the COMLEX happens during the physician's residency program. And it's a study of how they can integrate their medical knowledge and their clinical training, which is necessary for the unsupervised diagnosis and management of patients. Osteopathic physicians then will also complete either 3 to 7 years of residency training. I'm not an expert on the training of the naturopathic physician, and I'm not going to go into all the training of the osteopathic physician, but in speaking with our osteopathic physicians across the states, we're very concerned about the increase of prescribing rights without the increase in training. This Senate Bill 327, we do see this as an increase in prescribing rights. And we're concerned about an exclusionary formulary where drugs are automatically put on a formulary for naturopaths to be able to prescribe without proper oversight. We do agree that there is a need for primary care physicians in Oregon, but we are concerned about expanding a formulary as a knee-jerk or a short-sighted reaction to this need for primary care physicians. The osteopathic physicians is looking closely at the need for primary care physicians in the state of Oregon. A new osteopathic medical school is scheduled to begin in Oregon and Lebanon in 2011. This is an expansion of the Western University College of Osteopathic Medicine, which currently trains 30 students for the clinical rotations here in Oregon. The class in 2011 will be expanding to 100 students. And they've done this in a very careful way by making sure the clinical rotation opportunities are here, in addition to residency training. A new residency program through Samaritan Health Services is opening up this year with residencies in family medicine, internal medicine, and psychiatry. We think this response is an appropriate way to meet the needs of the primary care physicians in Oregon. I've been had the pleasure of sitting on the Scope of Practice Advisory Group, and I appreciate the work that Mr. Donovan put together in this packet. I've got this a little late, got this today, and would welcome the opportunity to sit on a work group or have further involvement as we go for the next steps in addressing these issues. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the osteopathic physicians oppose the expansion of scope for nurse practitioners when they first came forward?
I've been with the association for just 1 year, so I don't know all of the history of this, but in general, we are very concerned about any increase that doesn't include an increase of training. So the answer would be yes.
And I think it'll be very beneficial for your organization to look at the training and compare it with nurse practitioners and physicians in the pharmacology and in their basic sciences, and then see if the organization has the same opinion. Thank you.
Okay. Other comments? Thank you. Laura, would you? Is Laura still? Laura, would you come up, please? Phil, would you like to come up? Did you have a response to...
Senator Morissette, thank you for inviting me back up. My response to the question about increasing prescribing authority without increasing training is that twofold, actually. I would like to point out to the committee, and Senator Montes Anderson can hopefully confirm this is true, that nurse practitioners also have full primary care prescribing authority without the additional residency training that is required of DOs and MDs. So the fact that, this is my second point then, that we already have extensive, more actual pharmacology training built into the education and already have decades of experience with prescribing authority, and then we already have the model of safe prescribing authority in a primary care setting without additional residency training is enough of a response, I think, from our perspective about the safety and efficacy of increasing the prescribing authority.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. I guess my main concern at this point is the fact that it's an exclusionary rather than an inclusionary formulary. Do you want to comment on that? I mean, I see, you know, it's like you can do everything except what you choose to not do rather than make the decision as to what's included. So why the exclusionary rather than the inclusionary?
Do you want to address that first?
Sure. Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz. We discussed that issue quite extensively. And fundamentally, fundamentally, we believe that what this boils down to is making a formulary that is commensurate with the education and training of the profession. So we considered the idea of maintaining inclusionary and just limiting allowing the inclusionary formulary to accept synthetics medications. But at the same time, we recognize that the education and training of a naturopathic physician is such that they can manage these medications across the board, and frankly, it would be a lot of work to work through that an inclusionary naturopathic formulary rather than an exclusionionary one.
Follow up?
Can I add one thing to that? Thank you, Senator Morissette. Senator Cruz, part of the reason that we decided to switch over to an exclusionary formulary was on some of the advice that we received from pharmacists and from the Board of Pharmacy, that they advised us that it is much easier to facilitate and manage a formulary that, instead of having our current formulary is in the appendix, you can see it's multiple pages long and has lists and lists and lists and lists of what's included on the formulary. It's much easier to manage a formulary of exclusion that has a shorter list that's very clearly articulated of what you cannot prescribe, rather than having to constantly go through and verify what's been included, what's newly updated, what's in this, upwards of 10-page document, which is what it would become if it was maintained as an inclusionary formulary. So we went out to the stakeholders and we went down this course of action based on their recommendations.
Just to follow up, and I understand on the front end of this, you're looking at this mass, obviously, and clearly that would be the more expedited way to do it. I guess I'm just looking not at the initial input into the formulary, but I'm looking, to a degree I am there. It's just, but as we go out in time and you're looking at new drugs, I'm thinking of the rigor required to include something in a formulary would be more efficacious than just deciding. I mean, if a new drug comes out, you wouldn't necessarily have to do anything, and it's in your formulary. You'd have to take action to exclude it. And I'm just wondering if the rigor required to look at this new drug and make a decision for inclusion is a better way to do business.
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, you're right. That is, under this legislation, what we would be looking to do is for the formulary to look at existing drugs and new drugs into the future and determining whether they fit within the principles and the education and training of a naturopathic physician. So a new drug that is brought on would be considered by the formulary council. Having said that, if there's concern because there's kind of a lag time, I mean, quite frankly, it's not like naturopathic physicians are in a rush to go out and prescribe, new medications as they hit the market. It's just not within the scope of the kind of work that they do. Mm-hmm. Philosophy. Thank you.
That raises an interesting question, because when a new drug comes out, would it be automatically included unless you excluded it, or would it be on hold until you made a decision?
Senator Morissette, it would be allowable for a naturopathic physician to prescribe unless it was excluded. In other words, you are creating a prohibited list.
Okay. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that, I understand the expeditious nature of the inclusion. Given the testimony as to the level of education being equal or more than MDs and nurse practitioners for pharmacology, why would anything be excluded?
Well, Chair Morissette, Senator Telfer, that is a question that would be left with the formulary council to determine. The simple fact of the matter is that there is a belief, and chemotherapy drugs were referenced, that those are probably not something that fits in within the principles of naturopathic medicine. But at the onset, they would be allowed to be prescribed unless they were excluded. I will point to the legislation. It has an emergency clause on it, but it actually doesn't take effect till 2010. You say, well, that's kind of confusing. Well, the response to that is that by putting an emergency clause on the bill, you allow the formulary council to begin work upon passage of the bill, but naturopathic physicians wouldn't have an inclusionary formulary until 2010. So in other words, we built work time in.
And you did say that molecules are natural, right?
Senator Morissette, Senator Telfer, if I may address that too. We often cite chemotherapeutic drugs as an example because it's very clear that oncologists go through so many more years postgraduate training in their residencies and in a very narrow specialty to be able to gain the training expertise to prescribe and to manage those kinds of patients. And naturopathic education is more designed to educate and train our physicians to be family care doctors. And so there are some pharmaceuticals that clearly we recognize are not within the training and education of naturopathic physicians, and that's why we elected to maintain the formulary council to maintain a list of drugs that should be excluded, because we don't want the world. We don't want to have access to everything that may not necessarily be appropriate. Similarly, naturopathic physicians are not trained in hospital settings. We don't practice in hospitals, in inpatient facilities, and there are a whole list of pharmaceuticals in those settings, which are almost exclusively used in those settings. So we recognize that there are some limitations.
Senator DeMontis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if the nurse practitioner formulary is exclusionary or inclusionary?
Senator Morissette, Senator DeMontis Anderson, I think we're looking at each other. The answer is probably no.
Well, Senator,
we don't know.
Senator DeMontis Anderson, yeah, I pulled the legislation that was passed in 2008 to refresh my memory, and what it provides is that nurse practitioners have access to medications across the schedules, as I read the legislation, and it pulls it out Schedule 2 through 6.
And it's my understanding that the nurse practitioner formulary includes everything that is FDA approved.
Okay. Other questions?
Okay. If I could, Senator Morissette, I guess the last presentation I would like to make, and something of a question, I think, at this point for this body. To begin with, what has occurred to date has been very positive. We saw this process developing. We had the idea and began to meet with other healthcare stakeholders. I'll accept the admonishment that I miss David Walls until last week. But we actually, you'll find within, beginning on page 22 of this document, that we began meetings with interested stakeholders back in May of 2008. And you'll see that the headline there says, a summary of agreements and disagreements between proponents and opponents will be given to the committee. Well, frankly, I could not provide to you all a summary of agreements and disagreements because the meetings that we've been able to have been primarily information sharing, us presenting the idea, trying to provide the background, and fielding questions and answers. And that give and take, quite frankly, was quite positive. We got good feedback, and we also were able to answer questions that, quite frankly, I probably wouldn't have known the accreditation background for the National College of Natural Medicine, except for the fact that we had to research it as a result of this process, of this template. So I think it's been very positive in that regard. However,
What is the next step kind of becomes a question of the idea behind Sam's presentation was that there was some form of facilitation there. I think that we've gone a long ways in educating one another about this, but at some point we probably need to have a discussion and with the other stakeholders and try and arrive at those agreements and disagreements that this document gets. Because I think, frankly, you're still just a little bit short there. We don't have that done. But we're close. And we're a lot closer because of this template than we would have been otherwise.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to follow up because that was part of the guidelines was don't come to the committee until you have the entire guidelines taken care of. And I know, and that is where a facilitator probably is best because you did meet with organizations, but it was difficult for them to really know what they were supposed to do. And according to the guidelines, they were to put forth those statements that the osteopaths had so that they could be in the document. And hopefully you could have been able to work out the issues, the problems that they had. So like you said, you were the guinea pig, but we what had been suggested before was to have committee administrators, you know, take the guidelines and make sure that all of it was in the guidelines, and this you have not been trained on. I was talking with Rick Berkobian on that. And in talking with Rick, he said the committee administrator might be a good person to be able to make sure that everything was adhered to and then facilitate a group. We just haven't gotten that far.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Cruz.
And clearly, if we could have gotten Senator Mona Sanderson's bill through the entire process last time, I think that would have been helpful. Because at this point, it's work group and it's voluntary, and there's no there's nothing to necessarily drive the opposition to step forward at this point in time. And I wish we had closed the circle last session, but we didn't. Mr. Chair, I'm not. I think there's some merit here. I've expressed my concerns over whether it's in or out sort of thing, and that's more of a process issue and trying to look long term, mm-hmm. not just the immediacy of it, but long term. You know, 10 years from now, how the formulary looks compared to other formularies, and I would hate, and I don't know how many of the other formularies in the state are exclusionary or inclusionary, but I wouldn't want to set up one that operates in a different rubric than the others. So that's some of the information I'm kind of needing at this point.
Okay. Senator Morissette,
yes.
Senator Cruz, that desire for that forum, I think, is kind of what we need to determine next. I would have volunteered Jennifer to that job, but I'd like to see my bill get scheduled again. I've had other ideas about individuals, perhaps, that could create that forum. Maybe it's a member of this committee, but at some level, which frankly sits well with me, because throughout this whole process of looking at scope of practice issues, you know, we've not wanted to see the legislature's role get usurped. Mm-hmm. The idea is that at the end of the day, you're the decision makers, and that's appropriately so, and as I mentioned in my prior testimony, has led to some very good laws on the books.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I did talk with Rick Berkobian just a couple of days ago, and he said it was at least this time he felt within the scope of the committee administrator to get the parties together. It's certainly not one to sorry, Jennifer. But I think working with Rick Berkobian, because this is a new process, let's see if it works. Because I think that the concerns of the osteopaths need to be taken into account. And if there's and then if no one else comes forward, then we just assume there's no other opposition, and therefore we should go through with the bill. That's how I view it. If people aren't willing to come forward with their opposition to the work group, group, then that tells us there's no opposition to it, and we can go forward. That's how I look at it.
Well, I don't. I see this as you describe it, but I don't think one objection to a process is enough to kill the process. I think that what we're going to do is we're going to see if we can overcome the objections, and then we'll come back and hear the results of the meeting that has taken place, the work session, and so on and so forth. But I think that the preponderance of evidence is important as well. I mean, a single objection, I don't think, can kill something if there is a preponderance of evidence that this is a good thing to do. So that's where I am on this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I might suggest that our capable committee administrator look at a convening, and I would also suggest that probably the appropriate member of this committee to sit on that work group might be the sponsor of the bill. Just a suggestion, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I agree. Be very happy to.
I think
if that's what the chair wants.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a great process, and this is kind of the test run. But you know, there's more to come. We have other bills that will come before us. That this will serve as kind of a marker for us in terms of how we proceed. So. But the ultimate decision will fall with us, but with expert guidance, I hope. So, with that, we will close the work session, or the public hearing. We didn't have a work session.
No, we did not.
No work session. Okay. Other business before the committee? I don't see other business. So, we will adjourn.